Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
That's the nice thing about sandwiches is that as a chef is that you can control how the customer is going to experience it. Whereas if you're putting things on a plate and they're just diving in with a knife and fork, they may not eat it in the sequence that you would want them to. In a sandwich, they're kind of forced to.
Arlen Llewellyn puts a dynamite pesto on a sandwich for us today. It's made from carrot greens. Daniel Orr has his own pesto recipe to share. He uses mint. Author Rebecca Lando wanted to eat well without breaking the bank, so she wrote her cookbook, Working Class Foodies, a conversation with her about what makes a killer latke. Sometimes pesticides end up places they aren't supposed to be. That's a problem if you run an organic farm. And we hear the story of two gardeners who didn't let knee surgeries stop them from growing food. The stories our bloggers followed this week with Mark Chilla.
Prosecutors want to put the former CEO of Peanut Corporation of America behind bars for life. Stuart Parnell's crimes include conspiracy and obstruction of justice in connection with a salmonella outbreak that left 9 people dead and more than 700 sick in 2008 and 2009. Parnell was convicted last year for crimes connected to the outbreak. The U.S. Department of Justice released a 76-count indictment this week against Parnell and 2 other employees. The document outlines allegations that Parnell and company employees knowingly allowed tainted peanut butter to hit supermarket shelves, hid lab results, ignored warning signs, and forged documents to cover their tracks. The indictment comes soon after a stern warning from the Justice Department earlier this month that food companies that poison customers would face serious criminal and civil penalties. Researchers at Oregon State University are developing ways to farm, harvest, and cook dulse, a nutrition-packed red seaweed that has been harvested and eaten in cold water climates for centuries. And guess what? It tastes like bacon. Michael Morrissey is the director of the Oregon State University Food Innovation Center.
The bacon-like taste comes about more in how you prepare it, how you cook it. We've worked with cold-smoked dulse. It brings out more of the umami taste, kind of a savory, kind of meaty-like flavor that a lot of people, you know, associate with bacon.
Morrissey says dulse boasts up to 16% protein by dry weight, and like most edible seaweed, dulse is chock-full of vitamins and antioxidants. Researchers are also impressed with the yield of dulse crops. The center is producing about 20 to 30 pounds of the seaweed each week in 2 large 1,500-gallon tanks at the Hatfield Marine Science Center. Morrissey Center teamed up with the OSU Business School and a research chef to figure out ways to develop and market the seaweed. They're experimenting with dulse in peanut brittle, popcorn mix, and chips. They plan to introduce dulse crackers and salad oil to a local retailer this fall. Indiana's Food Bank Association is partnering with local farmers to buy produce, which would otherwise go to waste, at discounted prices. The Feeding Indiana's Hungry Farm to Food Banks program will take advantage of funds the state legislature allocates annually to food banks to buy fresh produce below wholesale value. The idea comes from a similar program already in place in Kentucky. In 2014, that state's program involved 373 farmers who were paid on average $1,450. And sour, sweet, salty, bitter. 4 tastes that have defined what makes food delicious, according to our taste buds. Recently, scientists also discovered umami, a distinctly savory taste recognized in foods like anchovies and truffles. Now, researchers at Purdue University want to add a 6th taste to the list, the taste of fat, called oleogustus. Researchers asked participants in their study to sort cups containing salty, sweet, umami, bitter, sour, or fatty solutions based on similarity. Since fat isn't considered a pleasant taste on its own, it was most often grouped with bitter, another taste that isn't considered pleasant on its own but can enhance the flavors of certain foods. Scientists then asked participants to further separate and group tastes based on similarity, which separated fat on its own. Researchers hope that by studying oleogustus's effect on our tastes, they can further refine food to make it taste better or increase the quality of substitutes. These articles are posted on our website. Find the list compiled in the podcast post at eartheats.org.
That's right. And join the conversation on Twitter at @EarthEats. We'll hear from Mark Chilla again a little bit later on today. In the U.S., farmers use nearly 900 million pounds of pesticides every year to protect their crops from weeds and insects. But sometimes those chemicals drift to neighboring properties, which can ruin crops on organic farms. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted has more.
Chert Hollow Farm sits nestled between rows of tall trees and a nearby stream in central Missouri. Eric and Joanna Reuter have been running an organic farm here since 2006. That means they don't use genetically modified crops and can only use a few approved kinds of chemicals and fertilizers.
We've traditionally raised about an acre and a half of pretty intensively managed produce, so it's a very, very productive acre and a half. We're really intercropping things.
Their neighbors grow acres of corn and soybeans, and they mostly got along. That is, until one July evening in 2014. Joanna was transplanting some broccoli when...
I basically heard this loud noise. It was coming north to south. And I basically yelled, "What the is that?"
They spotted a crop duster passing unusually close to their property. Shortly after experiencing headaches and irritation, they knew the wind had blown something chemical onto their land. But without knowing what it was, they were left in the lurch with a big asterisk on the authenticity of their organic crops.
We were concerned about how do we properly market ourselves, because we feel very strongly about openness and honesty, and we felt a little odd about marketing farm shares and such for the next year as a sustainable, chemical-free farm.
They've opted not to sell their produce this year and hope the contaminated soil will rebound for next year. It's a big hit for their small business. The guilty crop duster, he received a warning letter. The farm next door did not respond to my request for an interview.
We're more susceptible to that kind of contamination than we thought. And that raises the stakes significantly for a farm like ours.
Although conventional farms can also get hit with unwanted pesticides, it's the $40 billion organic industry that's most vulnerable. As more organic farms pop up, these kinds of disputes will only be more common. Casey Buell of the National Pesticide Information Center says there's no clear picture of how common pesticide drift is for the nearly 20,000 organic farms nationwide.
The data would get better and possibly resource allocation would increase if there was more consistent reporting.
That's why the organic industry is pushing for national regulations that prioritize drift investigations and consider stricter penalties for negligent farms. Here's Nate Lewis from the Organic Trade Association.
Once we do have a kind of a federal approach to pesticide drift, I suspect we'll be a lot more coordinated in our responses and potentially have better prevention strategies and more timely reaction to events when they do occur.
Farmers say investigations into chemical drift can drag on for months. Organic farmer Margot McMillan traipses through her muddy farmland about 25 miles from Chert Hollow. Here at Terrabella Farm, she grows all sorts of vegetables with help from Julie Wheeler.
One thing that you could really tell now this year, it looks like, I think we have been hit again, Julie, because look at that line. Looks worse than usual.
She reaches for a grape leaf showing signs of pesticide damage.
This curling of the leaf is real characteristic, and then there's a real thinness to the, you can kind of see the thinness of that leaf, and they look like, to me, they look like little fists, like, help, help.
McMillan is all too familiar with curled up foliage. In 2014, pesticide drift took a $25,000 chunk out of her tomatoes. She says this year she's been forced to grow her plants defensively, as she puts it. Large bushes now block the wind from the road. She moved crops over a crest away from other farms and moved the tomatoes inside the greenhouse.
Everybody that doesn't use the chemicals is running into this problem, and none of us want to go to some kind of a biotech tomato. We like our real tomatoes.
McMillan says a stricter penalty system could help improve accountability for pesticide negligence, but ultimately, planting defensively is what organic farmers currently have to do to survive. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Food, farm, and fuel stories from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. In the kitchen right away today with Chef Daniel Orr.
Well, today on Earth Eats, we're going to make some pesto. Now, a lot of people think of pesto as being that classic Genovese basil pesto that's so popular and famous in Italian cooking. But you can make pestos out of a lot of different things.
His pesto features mint. Arlen Llewellyn will also make a pesto for us. Hers uses a green you might be accustomed to tossing in the compost. That's in a bit. Daniel has welcomed us into his kitchen in Columbus, Indiana. Just outside is his mother's beautiful garden that's just bursting with lots and lots of fresh herbs.
Don't just let that stuff die in the garden. Go out there the day before the first big frost and pick all the herbs, and then you can make either one type of pesto out of each herb, or you can do a combination of herbs in one pesto. So you could do mint and basil, or you could add arugula to it. You could add spinach to your pesto. You can add parsley. You can add a little bit of rosemary. Today I'm going to take some mint and do a mint pesto, which is going to have a little bit of an Asian-inspired flavor by adding some ginger to it. The first thing I always do in the bottom of the blender is I put my whole garlic cloves. Garlic tends to take a little longer to puree than the rest, so if you add it towards the end, it might stay a little chunky and you'll get big pieces of it in there. I'm going to add a little bit of lemon zest, about a tablespoon of ginger. I'm going to add a little hot pepper. I'm going to add a jalapeno, but you could use whatever your favorite hot pepper is. All right, I'm going to add the mint. And I've just pulled off the tops of the mint, so we don't have any real tough stems in here. And I'm going to put in, you know, a good 3 or 4 cups of mint. All right, a little bit of salt. Okay, and some oil. We're just going to puree this. And it's really just as simple as that. Now, with a lot of traditional pestos, you do add some Parmesan cheese and nuts. Now, I've left this one completely vegan, and so there's a lot more uses for it. And then if you want to add the cheese, you can just add it at the time you're going to use it.
So pesto, as you may know, is an amazing base recipe because it's a simple ratio of ingredients, and you can substitute almost any aspect of those out.
Chef Arlen Llewellyn of Function Brewing.
So you can use almost any leafy vegetable for the basil. You can use almost any form of acid for the lemon juice, any form of nut for the pine nuts that are traditionally in it.
This recipe came out of her partnership with Jim Bauman of Freedom Valley Farm.
And we were talking to him about carrots, and he said, well, do you want to do anything with the tops? Because I've got a bunch of those. And I looked at him, and he was like, they make a great pesto. And it turns out that's a whole thing, but I didn't know anything about that.
Yes, you can eat carrot greens. She substituted the tops into her basic pesto recipe, along with some other substitutions, and it turned out so great. Here's the recipe.
So we use aged Gouda instead of Parmesan. We use that in a couple different components in our recipes in-house, and I think it makes a great addition to pesto. And cashews, which we use instead of pine nuts. I would hold off on adding any of the oil because you really want this hard stuff to be forced to be broken down by the food processor blade. If you start adding oil in there, it's just going to swim around the blade rather than being broken down. All right, I'm going to start grinding this up, pulsing it. Adding the oil in. So that's the reason for the handy little hole at the top of the food processor, is to be able to do something like this. Also, how you would do, for instance, mayonnaise, is to just stream it in very slowly.
So that's the pesto recipe at eartheats.org. This is just one component on the wood nymph panini they serve at Function. Chef Arlen will put it all together for us in the second half. Then,
we have a lot of different kinds of raised beds, and the idea is that it just brings everything up off of the ground, making it easier for people. They don't have to stoop as low, or if you're in a wheelchair, you can just kind of reach over, and your garden's right there. Makes it really easy.
Growing food as you age, and coming up with creative ways to make your garden work for you. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. and Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Rebecca Lando is the author of The Working Class Foodies Cookbook. It includes advice for stocking a pantry on the cheap, which organic ingredients you can do without. And then there's this one recipe she calls feta, red onion, and tomato paste salad, or how I spent an unair-conditioned summer in New York. We chatted with Rebecca earlier this year to learn about her personal food journey. The recipe in the book she takes most seriously, potato pancakes.
I'm usually pretty forgiving about how people make things. I like interpretation, but when it comes to latkes, I judge very, very harshly.
Like, what makes a good latke?
That's a very good question. Texture, I think, is really key. I like them when they're really, like, kind of lacy, so they get crispy on the outside, but they're soft inside, but they still have a little bite to them. I don't like when they're kind of like just mashed potatoes that have been fried.
She came by her pickiness honestly. She learned all about latkes from her grandfather. She posts cooking videos on YouTube under the name Working Class Foodies. She took the show on the road to Florida to her grandfather's kitchen.
It's actually our grandfather's potato latke recipe, but he's 98 and can't really make them anymore. So when we were down visiting family, our mom showed us the way that our grandpa taught her how to make them.
Basically, watch us make them, and you know, he's just correcting us the whole time and telling us that we're doing them wrong, and we finally serve them to him, and he's like, they're pretty good.
Oh. How is it, Dad?
A little sugar.
A little thicker.
She said thicker, you said sugar.
Yeah.
You have to make
family.
Them.
What are you going to do? Lando released a cookbook also called Working Class Foodies in the summer of 2013. It does include a recipe for latkes, but she recommends using Yukon Gold for their smooth texture. Her grandpa prefers russet potatoes because they're the most affordable option. Lando isn't a chef. She doesn't even claim expertise in the kitchen. She learned how to eat seasonally and nutritiously on a budget out of necessity.
You know, I went to college in New York. I was, you know, a student with a very limited budget to spend on food. And I found that, like, the supermarkets had kind of sad quality produce, but they charged a lot of money for it. And right outside of my dorm was the Union Square Green Market 4 days a week. And the food there was beautiful, tasted amazing, and was actually more affordable than what was on offer at the supermarkets. I just kind of started, without trying to, like, have a philosophy or be part of a thing, just shopping at the green market.
Then, because of her budget, she had to keep her meals to under $8 a plate. That's still an expensive meal, especially if it's home-cooked. But Lando was comparing that to the price of a sad salad bar lunch in Manhattan in 2009. That's how she described it. She could have easily made it under that $8 mark if she cut meat out of her recipes. But this former vegetarian had two reasons for keeping the meat in.
A, that's been done, and B, that only addresses part of a problem. This country eats a lot of meat, and not a lot of it is grown or raised that well in terms of the animal welfare and the environment and the health once it gets on your plate. And so part of it was I also wanted to show how to eat high-quality meat affordably, and the biggest part of that is to eat it in smaller amounts.
And choosing less popular cuts. Organ meats, anyone?
Tacos de lengua, which is, you know, beef tongue tacos, because that's an off cut. Or, you know, maybe you get a steak, but the steak isn't the centerpiece of the meal. The salad and the vegetables that you serve with it are the centerpiece of the meal.
And don't buy the pre-packaged cuts.
Let's say that I really want to do, like, braised chicken thighs or something. I will actually get a whole chicken. First of all, it's a better value. You're getting more bang for your buck when you buy a whole chicken rather than like four chicken thighs, and you have more to work with. So you have your chicken thighs, and then you can break it down. You have the breasts, you know, you can save the bones, you can make a stock. there's a lot more you can do with that, you know, whatever it is that you spend on a whole chicken than the one meal, or maybe at best two meals that you get out of just buying a package of chicken thighs.
Rebecca Lando has lots of other tips for eating well on a budget in her book and on her web series. Both share the name Working Class Foodie. How many different types of cheese do you have in this place?
Oh my gosh.
Chef Arlen Llewellyn again at Function Brewing.
On sandwiches alone, we have aged Gouda, smoked Gouda, aged cheddar, Havarti, pepper jack, and smoked blue cheese. We have Capriole goat cheese, which we use in an appetizer. We have five cheeses for the cheese plate. And we have feta, which we make into sun-dried tomato whipped feta and that we put on salads. That didn't count, but that's a lot, right? Cheese and vegetables. I mean, I guess we've opened a cheese and vegetable restaurant with some bread and some meat on the side.
The sandwiches at Function are, in a word, intense. There is a lot going on between the two slices of bread. Llewellyn has a very specific way of constructing each of the sandwiches. So with this wood nymph panini, the carrot top pesto goes on the bottom. So that's the first flavor that hits your tongue after you bite through the bread.
That's a nice thing about sandwiches is that as a chef is that you can control how the customer is going to experience it. Whereas if you're putting things on a plate and they're just diving in with a knife and fork, they may not eat it in the sequence that you would want them to. In a sandwich, they're kind of forced to. So we're just going to spread the pesto on. I do not believe in less is more a lot of times. I think more is great when you're talking about flavor components. And make sure to take it all the way to the side so that you're not getting any bland bites in there. So this is the raisin aioli. We plumped the raisins in a water steam bath and then blended them with mayonnaise. So these are roasted local carrots, braised collard greens, braised in a little bit of butter and salt and pepper. We are going to top that with some blue cheese and then some Fair Oaks Havarti and the raisin aioli, and that will seal the deal. So we're going to go ahead and put this on the panini press.
No stovetops in the Function kitchen, so these panini presses work hard for Llewellyn and her staff.
I'd say we're pretty good. We're just going to let that sit. It's very important to let sandwiches rest for a couple minutes. Because right now that bottom piece of bread is super hot. So if you put it on a flat surface, it's going to steam on the inside up against the plate and the bottom piece will be soggy. So we put it on that resting rack for a couple minutes to lose the most intense heat before we cut it and before we put it on a plate.
The sandwich looks ridiculous.
Thank you. It's hopefully a good mix of unctuous richness, but also things that make you feel like you're eating something good for you.
Gooey and rich, that's for sure. See the finished sandwich at eartheats.org. Bending over to pull weeds, walking from plant to plant, gardening can be a challenge as we age. We hear from a couple elderly gardeners now about how they grow food despite some physical challenges. Mark Chilla brings us this story from Indiana's Area 10 Agency for Aging.
So this is all a wildlife garden, and it's a low-maintenance garden. I planted...
Anne Robbins walks through her garden with the help of a cane. Her pace is slow, but it's measured and with purpose.
Fruit trees and flowering trees. And
her garden is not your average garden. It's more of a wildlife sanctuary, home to dozens of flowers, trees, vegetables, herbs, and shrubs, as well as creatures like birds, toads, bees, butterflies, and moths.
Insects of all sorts, but some really rare ones, like the Cercopian moth, the largest moth in North America.
When she started building this garden back in 2009, she spent about 2 hours a day working on it. Today, partly because of her limited mobility, it's more like 2 hours a week.
This is a low-maintenance garden, and all you have to do is cut off the dead...
As a former biologist, zoologist really, Anne is very knowledgeable, and she takes her love and knowledge of wildlife to the gardening program at the Endright Center, part of Indiana's Area 10 Agency on Aging.
When we were trying to get people to come to the classes, a lot of older people told me, oh, you know, I'd love to do that. I used to garden, but I just can't do it anymore.
That was Laura Cray. She's the nutrition program manager for Area 10 and runs the gardening program at the Endright Center.
So that just kind of got me thinking, I wonder if there's a way that older people could continue to garden.
Gardening as you get older can be a challenge. There's the issue of mobility, not to mention the constant bending over one has to do to tend to one's garden. To help address some of these issues, Cray has introduced some new things, like looser soil for easy weeding and very tall raised planting beds.
So we have a lot of different kinds of raised beds, and the idea is that it just brings everything up off of the ground, making it easier for people. They don't have to stoop as low, or if you're in a wheelchair, you can just kind of reach over and your garden's right there. It makes it really easy.
Cray explains that gardening can be beneficial for people as they age.
It's great for people with arthritis to keep moving and keep those joints lubricated, so it reduces their pain. It's also great to get outside. You get a lot of sunlight that way, so you get more vitamin D, which is great for everybody, but especially older folks.
It's also a great source of nutritious food. Part of the gardening program's mission is to provide food for Enright Center's Cooking for One class and the mobile food pantry on site. But ultimately, the gardening program is a community. It's a place for people who love gardening to gather and share how they've had to adapt their gardening techniques as they've gotten older, and perhaps learn a few new techniques along the way.
It's a lot of fun. I enjoy it even still, even though it's hard on us now. I'm 70, be 76.
Jean Bruce is also a member of the gardening program. Jean gardens mostly for food. Her beans are her specialty, according to her kids.
Because every time they'd come over for dinner, our kids, they'd always want my homemade green beans, so I plant some more so I'll have enough.
She and her husband used to grow and can food to help provide for their family.
The canning, I did that, and we canned our food because that's what we needed to raise those boys.
Today, she gardens mostly for the enjoyment.
It's just part of your life. I mean, it's good for your soul. I guess that's one way of saying it. It's good for your soul.
As Jean has gotten older, she has had to adapt her gardening technique. She has knee problems and is getting a knee replacement surgery soon, so that means she has trouble tending to her beans. She's come up with a solution, though. Grow her beans along a pole, known as pole beans.
When they grow, then all you got to do is just reach up there and get them instead of getting down and trying to pick the bush beans. That's a little harder for us.
Addressing the challenges of aging in gardening requires careful planning. For Jean, it meant constructing those poles before the growing season. For Anne and her wildlife sanctuary, it's been designed from the beginning to weather any challenges.
I have 30 moths and butterflies.
Her low-maintenance garden is more or less self-sustaining. The diversity of plant and animal life means it's kind of like its own ecosystem. This is crucial because Anne, like Jean, is getting knee surgery soon.
I have to stay out of the garden for about a month.
But since she's designed her garden to take care of itself, that means it will be there waiting for her when she's recovered. For Earth Eats, I'm Mark Chilla.
Hear this story again, see pictures, and hey, find lots of gardening advice as well at eartheats.org. Our crew at Earth Eats is Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. You are great company today. Thanks for being here. I'm Annie Corrigan.